It's Central Time. I'm Rob Farage. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, we want to know about your childhood dreams. When you were young, what did you want to be when you grew up? Does it seem funny now, or did you make it happen? We'll be taking your calls coming up. First, the new trade deal between the U.S., Mexico, and Canada has now been signed, but questions remain about whether it can be delivered. The North American leaders added their signatures this morning from the sidelines of the G20 summit in Argentina. President Trump called the U.S.-Mexico-Canada agreement a truly groundbreaking achievement. But before it can be implemented, each country's legislature needs to approve it, and for Congress, that might be a tall order. Both Democrats and Republicans have been critical of various parts of the deal, but Trump remained hopeful that it would pass. The deal would replace the North American Free Trade Agreement, which Trump has called the worst trade deal of all time. Here's President Trump talking about his hopes for the bill.
I look forward to working with members of Congress and the USMCA partners, and I have to say it's been so well reviewed, I don't expect to have very much of a problem to ensure the complete implementation of our agreement.
Megan Casella is a trade reporter for Politico Pro. Megan, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thanks so much for having me.
Well, we'll get into whether this will be an easy sell in Congress in just a bit. First, give us the main highlights of this new agreement and how much it's different from NAFTA.
The agreement is largely the same. I mean, some senators will say between 90 and 95% of the deal is largely the same as the original NAFTA. But that remaining segment, you know, even though it's small, there are some substantial policy changes. The most notable are probably in the automotive sector. There are stricter rules mandating how much of a car must be produced within North America in order to be sold in North America with zero tariffs on it. There's rules on how much of the steel and aluminum and other materials used in the car must be sourced from within North America as well. And as another provision mandating that at least a certain percentage of the car must be produced by workers or earning at least $16 an hour. So the auto sector has a lot to adjust to. There are some dispute settlement provisions that have changed a little bit that change investment protections under the pact. Canada has agreed to open up its dairy sector a little bit more. And there are some brand new provisions, things like protections for workers that aim to prevent against the discrimination based on gender and sexual identity and that sort of thing. So there's sort of, you know, the changes pretty much span the gamut, and they're not a huge amount of changes, but there's definitely some significant things that all three countries would have to adjust to.
And you mentioned that auto issue. This comes after GM says it's laying off about 14,000 people, closing some factories in the U.S. and Canada. And prior to the signing ceremony, Canadian Prime Minister Justin Trudeau called that development a heavy blow. And he added this, directing it at President Trump.
Make no mistake, we will stand up for our workers and fight for their families and their communities. And Donald, it's all the more reason why we need to keep working to remove the tariffs on steel and aluminum between our countries.
And along with dairy and a couple other things, the steel and aluminum tariffs have been one of the biggest sticking points between the U.S. and Canada. Does this new agreement end the discussion on steel and aluminum, or is that something that gets handled separately?
It's going to get handled separately, and that's to the dismay of initially Canada and Mexico, as well as a number of business groups and industries operating in all three countries. They really want to see these tariffs removed, as well as then the retaliatory tariffs that Canada and Mexico imposed in response to Trump's tariffs on steel and aluminum. So those discussions will continue, and you know, industries that are really affected by them are hoping that it's as soon as possible, but there's no set timeline at this point as to when those might be removed.
Talking to Megan Casella, trade reporter for Politico Pro, about this new replacement deal for NAFTA signed by the leaders of U.S., Mexico, and Canada earlier today. Still needs approval in Congress and the legislatures of both countries. And let's get to that. You've been reporting on this, Megan. First of all, before we get into specific objections, does Congress have to give a straight up or down vote on the deal as written, or do they have some wiggle room where they can say, we don't like this bit, but here's a little something we can do about it?
It's a little bit of both. So they can't amend the deal itself. Now that it's signed, it would be very, very hard for the Trump administration to go back and reopen those talks with Canada and Mexico. But Congress will have some say over what's called the implementing bill or the implementing legislation. And through that vehicle, they can try to say, you know, I have grievances with this provision or that one. And the administration can and will have to go back and forth with Congress over the next several months to try to use that implementing legislation to address some of their changes or their concerns.
And this is a big, huge treaty on trade, and there's something in it for lots of people not to like. Let's look at some of the different objections now. You wrote that in Politico anyway, I saw some conservatives in Congress don't like the thing you mentioned, protections for LGBT employees against discrimination included in this. This could motivate some Republicans in particular to vote against the deal?
They could, yeah. So it was about 40 conservatives in the House of Representatives that came out against those provisions a couple of weeks ago. And what they were saying was, you know, a trade agreement is not the place to make new social policy. And they said, a number of them started to say that this could jeopardize their support for the agreement. So when you pair that with, you know, Republicans are sort of have always been the party of free trade, and their votes had been expected to be easier for the administration to pick up for this agreement, because we're also seeing Democrats start to defect as well. So the deal sort of under scrutiny and under fire by both sides of the aisle.
And we're seeing some Democrats, including Congressman Mark Pocan of Wisconsin, worried about the deal's labor standards and how they're going to be enforced. What kind of concerns are they raising?
They're saying that, you know, that's always been a complaint with NAFTA, the original, is that it didn't go far enough to protect workers. It sent jobs overseas. It incentivized offshoring, drove down wages. And the administration went very far to try to work with Democrats and address those concerns. But what these Democrats are saying is that it just doesn't go far enough. And even as far as it does go, the standards still aren't enforceable. So they're worried that Mexico in particular might see what's written in the agreement and then not listen to it and not be legally forced to abide by the rules that are written into the new deal.
Then I've seen objections in Congress along particular regional economy lines. Some Democratic senators in particular worried about how this might affect the auto industry and other American manufacturing. I saw a tweet, I think, from Senator Marco Rubio saying it doesn't do enough to protect Florida fruit growers, for example. Are we going to see a lot of these regional issues popping up as this gets debated?
We absolutely are. And that's actually one thing that's really interesting about trade, is that it often doesn't cleanly fall along party lines. It's based on regional lines. And so Chuck Schumer, we saw him come out saying that he's particularly interested in how it's going to affect the dairy sector, given huge dairy interests in his home state of New York. And so that's what we're going to see. You know, and then in a very trade-dependent state like Washington State, for example, we're probably going to see those lawmakers, regardless of party, are more likely to support the deal just because they're so dependent on trade, international trade. And so we're going to see a lot of regional differences.
Now, Congress has to sign off on this, but I guess a big question is, which Congress, the one that's there now or the one that gets sworn in January? We've seen some Senate Republicans, including Wisconsin's Ron Johnson, saying, hey, let's vote on this now before the new Congress is sworn in early next year. Is that something that's likely to happen?
Not likely at all. It's actually all but certain, I would say, that it's going to be next Congress that is going to have to deal with this. It was sort of a last-ditch hope by Ron Johnson and others, led by Senator Pat Toomey, a Pennsylvania Republican. And what Toomey has told us is that he felt it would be easier for his concerns to be addressed if it were dealt with sooner rather than later. And I'm not sure, you know, if everyone would agree with that. Others might hope for more time so that they have, you know, more opportunity for conversations with the administration and changes and that sort of thing. But it was, you know, there was this push. I guess it was last week we saw the latest push to get a vote as soon as possible. But because of a number of procedural steps that the administration still has to go through, it would be almost impossible for them to get it done in the current Congress.
So that means it'll go to a Democratic-led House, a Republican-led Senate, plus, as you mentioned, all these regional wrinkles that might cross party lines in either direction. President Trump was saying, as we heard earlier, he thinks this is a pretty easy sell to Congress. Do you see it as an easy sell to Congress?
I think that's a little bit too optimistic to call it an easy sell. I mean, that's not to say that it will definitely fail. I just think there's going to be several months probably of back and forth and of work between the administration and Congress and hearings and that sort of thing, analyses of, you know, what this actually means for each industry before you're starting to see lawmakers change their tune and say, this is a deal that they can vote for and that they would like to see pass.
This is a huge hypothetical, but if we go through this months-long process and Congress doesn't approve it, where are we on trade? Does old NAFTA still apply? Are we just under the World Trade Organization rules with our neighbors to the north and south? What happens if this doesn't go through?
If all goes as is normal, you know, in normal circumstances, the original NAFTA stays in place until the USMCA or NAFTA 2.0 is passed. The wrinkle that's thrown in there is that the president himself has often threatened to withdraw from the original NAFTA in order to force a vote on the new one. And in that way, he would tell lawmakers, you know, you better pass this new deal because otherwise we're left with nothing. And that would severely impact supply chains all across North America, industries, the U.S. economy. That would spell major changes and major disruption. So if he does, in fact, follow through on that threat, that would be huge. But we actually haven't heard that threat of withdrawal revived recently. So I think, but lawmakers, again, are still sort of on edge. You know, what if he does? And so I think that's the danger in delaying too long and in threatening not to vote for this agreement. If you're a free trade lawmaker who wants to see some form of a trade deal remain in place, it's sort of a risky thing to vote totally against the USMCA, because what if then the president goes and withdraws from the original NAFTA? So it's a gamble.
Now, I know you are focused on Washington, D.C. and Congress. Is there any sign that this is going to be tough in the Canadian or Mexican legislatures, or is the U.S. Congress potentially the biggest sticking point?
From what I understand, each of those countries might run into, you know, a wrinkle here and there or an obstacle here and there. But the U.S. Congress is absolutely going to be the biggest story and the biggest one to watch.
Megan, thanks a lot for bringing us up to date.
Thanks for having me. I appreciate it.
Megan Casella is a trade reporter for Politico Pro. We talked with her about the future of the U.S.-Mexico-Canada trade agreement, the new version of NAFTA, which was signed today by the leaders of the three countries. As we've been hearing, it still needs to be approved by Congress and the legislatures in Canada and Mexico. Many of us, speaking of kids, as kids we had big dreams, some practical, some less so, and we're wondering what you wanted to be when you grew up. Call 800-642-1234 to tell us about it. What was that dream job when you were a kindergartner or maybe in middle school? Did you find yourself pursuing it? Give us a call at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Amy is with us to start us off in Wauwatosa. Amy, hi.
Hi.
What was your dream job growing up?
I wanted to be a marine biologist.
Cool.
And study giant squid.
Squid. Okay, what got you hooked on a giant squid as a kid?
Well, I lived in rural Wisconsin, surrounded by dry, dusty farmland itself. And it just seemed like the depths of the ocean were such an interesting place. That dream didn't come true because we live near freshwater and not saltwater, but I still am fascinated by creatures in the ocean.
Cool. So you keep up that interest, go to aquariums, I imagine, whenever you're near one?
Yes. Mm-hmm.
All right. Amy, thank you so much for getting us started at 800-642-1234. We asked around here at WPR, by the way, what people wanted to do. We had some people who wanted to do something like they're doing now. Now, Melissa, who you hear on the morning news, she's our morning edition host, says she used to pretend interview on an old cassette recorder. Never in a million years did she think she'd end up doing it for real. And now here she is on the air. Brianna, an Ideas Network producer, says when she was 12, she decided she wanted to be a journalist. She shadowed a journalism professor nearby, and she was sold. And Corey wanted to be Barbara Walters when she was a kid. She'd hide and tape record conversations and then report the story. That could have been awkward at family gatherings, potentially. You could join in at 800-642-1234. We're taking your calls. What did you want to be when you grew up? Call in and tell us about it, whether you ended up doing it or not, whether in hindsight it seems wacky and impractical. Also, we had a would-be Queen of England amidst us. Marissa in audience services, that was her dream job. She says it didn't work out. And Chris in our marketing department wanted to be Captain America. Chris didn't end up becoming a superhero, unfortunately, or maybe Chris is just protecting the old secret identity. We'll never know. Yasmin is with us next in Menominee. Yasmin, hi there.
Hi.
What was your story?
Really,
what did you want to be?
Interesting topic. Yeah. So growing up, I actually didn't know what I wanted to be, and people would ask me, and I would say ridiculous things like, I want to be a butterfly or some weird thing like that. And I asked my mom one day, because I was desperate, and she said, well, I wanted to be a fashion designer when I was your age. So ever since she told me that, I've been wired to pursue that, and I even went to UW Stout to pursue applied, apparel design because of that.
Cool. So you actually took your childhood dream and what you eventually figured out your childhood dream was, and you're working on that right now?
I changed my major two years ago because it wasn't practical to continue pursuing that at the time. But in the future, I'll definitely do something about that.
Yasmin, thank you so much for calling and sharing that. We'll go next to Tom with us in Madison. Tom, hi.
Hi. I wanted to be the quarterback of the Green Bay Packers.
Yeah, I bet you're the only person in Wisconsin who ever had that dream, Tom.
That's probably so. It was taken, though, when I got old enough.
Yeah. So did you play football, like, at the Pee Wee or high school levels?
I played through college, actually.
You did?
When I was telling my sons about it one time, the oldest son said, well, why didn't you play pro football? And I said, well, it wasn't good enough. He said, why didn't you get good enough? Well, good point. I didn't work hard enough.
Yeah, I think sometimes it takes even more than that, Tom. Thanks a lot for calling and sharing that. I, as a younger kid, definitely saw a sports star or something. It turned out not good enough at pretty much any athletic activity to star in that. Thanks a lot for the call, Tom. Mark is with us now in Three Lakes. Mark, hi.
Hi.
What was your goal, your dream?
I guess I'm been a scout my whole life, a Cub Scout and Boy Scout. And all I ever wanted to do was to be self-sufficient, which makes me, you know, a little bit of a, how can I put it, a person who tries to do for himself.
Sure. And do you think you're most of the way there, part way there? How'd it go?
I am now over 60 years old, and earlier I was told that if you were you put your 10, 20, 30% in the bank, and you could live off the interest. But it didn't work.
All right. Well, good luck to you, Mark, as you keep seeking that dream. I'll go next to Abraham in Green Bay. Abraham, hi.
Hi. So I was born in a refugee camp in Kenya. And as anybody might imagine, there were not a whole lot of different jobs and different careers around, besides, you know, the local school teacher and the police officer and the doctor and that kind of stuff. But there was one thing that always had my imagination. There were, you know, planes flying, you know, quite a lot above the camp, and you could see them. And, you know, this place was, you know, in a sunny environment, so we had a lot of bright blue skies, and you could see the tiny little planes flying far above. And so I always wondered how those things were made, you know, what the magical piece was. And so I wanted to be naturally a pilot or, you know, somebody that makes planes. But now I am graduating this upcoming semester with my computer science degree from UW Green Bay. So.
A lot of computers on those planes. You could still be part of that, Abraham. Thank you so much for sharing that story. It's a wonderful story. Thank you. I will go next to Nancy. We're asking you what you wanted to be when you were growing up. And whether you ended up doing it or not. Nancy is with us now in Grafton. Nancy, hi.
I wanted to be a nurse, but it was a week before Christmas when I was 14 years old, and a drunk driver hit my dad's car, and my mother was killed. And I was a farm girl, oldest of six kids. And so there was no way that I could ever finish high school. I did get past the first year, and then later on, when I was 18, I got married. And my husband and I had a really big family, 14 children. And so then, after my last baby was born, I decided I'm going to go to MATC and I'll be a nursing assistant. And that's what I got to do. And even at my age yet, I still care about people who are probably older than me. And I love it, you know, whatever it is that you decide to do. Do something that fills you up in your heart. Don't let it be money. Let it be what makes you feel good, too. And it worked out for me, and I'm still at it. So God bless us, everyone.
Fantastic, Nancy. Thank you so much for sharing that story. Sorry about your loss at an early age. Congratulations, though, on eventually living that dream. You can keep sharing your job, your dream job as a kid on the Ideas Network Facebook page. We're taking your comments there. Time for one more call. I think Brian is with us in Green Bay. Brian, hi.
Hi, how's it going?
Good. What was your dream job?
My dream job was to become a dentist.
Okay. What was it that, as a kid, that made you think dentist?
When I was four, my first visit at the dentist office, I received a toy, and I thought that was pretty neat. So I thought I'd wanted to give toys to kids.
That's great. And did you end up pursuing dentistry?
I did, yep.
And? You're a dentist now?
Great. Yes, I am a dentist now.
And you keep toys handy?
I do. I have a treasure chest, so.
All right. And you'll inspire the next generation. Brian, thanks so much for calling in and sharing.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
Yeah, thanks for sharing your story. Again, keep sharing your dream jobs, what you wanted to be growing up, over at the Ideas Network Facebook page. Thanks so much to everybody who called in. What a great range of stories we've heard from people. You know, I thought, actually, there's a while I was thinking rock star because I did music stuff. I do still play in a rock band. Star? No, that one fell a little short. And that's really okay with me. You are probably not as excited about vinegar as our next guest is, but that's okay. He is here to win you over. He says that sour flavor is something we crave, and it can be the key to unlocking additional flavors in our cooking. We're going to find out more about incorporating that tangy vinegar flavor into some dishes and how to make our own vinegar, too. Turns out it's not all that hard. Jonathan Sawyer is a chef, a founder of several restaurants, living in Cleveland, Ohio. He's won a James Beard Award, calls himself Vinegar Obsessed, and is the author of the new cookbook, House of Vinegar, The Power of Sour. John, welcome to Central Time.
Hey, Rob. Absolute pleasure for having me on.
Well, now, I like vinegar. I'm liking it more and more over the years, but I don't hold a candle to you. You are really into vinegar. What led you down that path?
Well, if we look at vinegar historically, it predates ale, wine, and even citrus fruit in recipes. It is the original balancer of flavors, and not to mention many other phenomenal properties that it can possess. But for us, it was really about making something that, even if our recipes are the same as our neighbors, makes us just a little bit different. And when you make your own vinegar and when you have your own craftsmanship of anything that's sort of, you know, fata en casa or made in the house, you have that opportunity to really put your thumbprint on what you're cooking.
And you have a wide variety of recipes in the book, not just on making vinegar, but how to use it. And it's everything from, you know, marinating an entree or in a salsa and sauces, all the way to bringing out flavors in desserts. I don't think most people think of vinegar as being that flexible.
Truly. And in addition to, you know, a small chapter on how to and cocktails. But, you know, some of the greatest recipes that we uncovered over our years of sort of replacing citrus with vinegar as an act of being more local than, you know, sort of our neighbors, we found American dessert recipes from the Dust Bowl and from the Depression when, you know, money was tight. And they used vinegar and baking soda as a leavener more often than anything else because chicken eggs were, you know, your main source of protein. If you didn't have money, you would never waste them on a dessert. So there is a huge tradition, especially in America, of using vinegar in desserts.
We'll get into making our own vinegar, but suppose we're not quite there yet. How do we pick good stuff? How do we know if we're getting good vinegar if we're buying it at the store?
Well, beyond the obvious, you know, look at the list of ingredients. If you see fructose, corn syrup, sugar, food dye, don't buy it. Don't even spend a dollar on it. Don't even clean your windows with it because distilled vinegar is made natural and only 10% more expensive than the other garbage. Secondly, I think a born-on date is more important than an expire date, and that is universal for any product you're buying. And I think thirdly, if you see sediment and cloudy or the words live, active, or probiotic, that's a vinegar that is phenomenal and one you want to buy.
And what should be in our arsenal, whether we make it ourselves or are buying it off the rack? What kind of vinegars do you recommend we have in our toolkit?
Honestly, Rob, that's one of the greatest questions someone's asked me about the book is, what does the vinegar pantry look like in an ideal home scenario? For us, we really like to have two sort of high-quality vinegars that are red wine and or sherry, and then we have what we call workhorse vinegars. One of them would be white, and that could be white wine or champagne or rice wine, depending on your, let's say, continent of inspiration of most common cuisine. And I think the last one would be either malt or beer. So you have four vinegars total at your house.
So beer vinegar. I got to say, I don't think I've ever in my life interacted with beer vinegar.
Unknowingly, I think you have interacted with regularly because malt vinegar is just malted
beer.
Oh,
okay. So I've had it all the time then.
Yeah.
Okay.
If you've had fish and chips, you've had beer vinegar of some sort.
I get it. Okay. Now, we're talking about the new book, House of Vinegar, with Jonathan Sawyer, about how to use vinegar and, yes, how to make it. And we'll get into some recipes in just a bit, what we can do with vinegar, store-bought or homemade. John, I want to look at making vinegar. What I love about a lot of your recipes is there are precisely in a lot of these one ingredient.
Yes. You know, I think the book for us was really important, it being our second. The first one called Noodle Kids, which my kids and I wrote, of just sort of how to cook at home, and my wife as well. This one is more sort of, this is what we do. This is what vinegar is. It's a singular ingredient, and you don't realize how important it is, almost all the way to the point where you think of, like, salt is number one, vinegar is number two, then fat, then sugar, then umami, in terms of balancing your taste buds.
And if we want to try making our own, we just want to make, say, a basic red wine vinegar, talk us through the procedure. How hard is this?
It's actually the easiest thing in the world, and naturally it's what any liquid that has just a little bit of sugar, just a little bit of carbohydrates, and just a little bit of protein, which is naturally present inside of every vegetable and every fruit that you consume on your daily basis. So wine vinegar takes typically three times longer than, let's just call them, malted vinegars. So whether it's a beer vinegar or it's a malt vinegar, those are vinegars you're going to see, or cider vinegar, those are vinegars that you're going to see very quick results, and it's going to be really rewarding and help you sort of build up to the time that you would wait for a red wine or white wine vinegar. So my recommendation for home vinegar, you know, aficionados, is to buy a beer that has no hops in it, that has sort of the biggest grain bill that you can think of, but is less than 15% alcohol, and you pour it into a container, you put a cheesecloth over top of it, you keep it away from cleaning products and cat urine and sunlight, and about a month later, you'll have vinegar. Now, there's a little more involved in that, but what I'm saying is that any liquid that you put in a jar and allow to access itself to oxygen will eventually turn into vinegar. So the brewer and the winemaker's job is actually to stop that liquid right before it turns into vinegar.
Yeah, vinegar wants to make itself, it sounds like.
Yeah, 100%. I mean, the flora and fauna that are in the air naturally, you know, either reacting with our allergies or interacting with our plants, it has the acetobacter, as it's called in the nerd world, of what will make vinegar, what will turn a liquid through that time, oxygen, and the other requisite sort of liquids that turn it into vinegar.
Now let's start putting our vinegar to work. You shared a few recipes with us, and we've got the recipes and the vinegar recipes to go along with them at WPR.org/Food Friday. Now, I love doing a quick fridge pickle. I'm a big fan of this lately. You've got a modern classic red onion pickle. That sounds like it'd be, I mean, I almost want to snack on it. It'd be great in salads, on a sandwich, whatever. Talk about this red onion pickle we make with vinegar.
I mean, true story, right? It is a modern classic because just like sun-dried tomatoes in the late 90s and pork belly in the early 2000s, every modern restaurant has a red onion pickle, and every restaurant has a mild variation. And I think that's the fun of being at home, is you can look at your red onions or your white onions. You could look at our recipe. You could look at your inspiration and just tweak it a little bit to be yours. But every burger, every salad, every braise, every gremolata tastes better with just a little bit of that punchy, crunchy pickled red onion.
And after the initial processing here, it's just sitting in the fridge for about a day and then it's ready to rock?
Yeah, and honestly, you could do it the same day. For us, it's kind of, you know, not yielding the same results as a, you know, 6 month slow fermentation lacto pickle. But if you're making a burger tonight and you got some leftover red onion from last night, you just simply boil it rather than pouring the hot liquid over top and allowing it to rest.
And
so you just make a pickling liquid, essentially poach the onions in that pickling liquid, allow it to rest, allow it to cool, and boom, you got a pickle.
Now, my surprise ingredient in this one, I'm seeing kombucha.
Yeah, I mean, what we found is through this sort of life of researching fermentation, there is so much synergy between kombucha, beer, wine, vinegar, sourdough bread, yogurt, and cheese that oftentimes when you combine the two in a recipe, it's just sort of magnifying what you're doing with the natural base ingredient.
That's fine. Now, we'll get to a couple more recipes in just a bit, but let's just talk about, hey, you're cooking some kind of meat. You want to marinate it for a bit or have a sauce for it. How do we match the right vinegar to the right meat and the right recipe that goes with it?
You know, the old adage is true. If it grows together, it goes together. So, you know, red wine vinegar and Japanese food, not too many places where it's going to make sense. Rice wine vinegar or a very clean white wine vinegar, okay, you're gonna figure that part out. But it's also about personal taste and sort of where you are in terms of acidity. You know, every vinegar can have a variation of all the way down to 1.4 pH and up to 3.7 pH. Obviously, 7 being a basic, you know, sort of flat liquid. So there is, you know, many different minutiae to sort of look at when you're thinking about it. But for us, it's always an equation of how much fat is in the product that we're going to enjoy, what temperature is going to be served at, how much sugar and salt are in there, and then we balance that. The only balancer inside of all of those components is the vinegar, is the acidity, or a combination of vinegar and citrus.
We're talking to John Sawyer, chef and restaurant owner in Cleveland. He's talking to us about how to make our own vinegar, how to cook with vinegar. He's the author of the new book, House of Vinegar, The Power of Sour. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you love to cook with vinegar? What kind or kinds do you use? What do you like to use them for? What kind of recipes? Do you have a favorite vinaigrette salad dressing to buy or make yourself? Have you ever tried to make your own vinegar? Do you want some advice for our guests on how to make your own or how to use vinegar in your own cooking? Maybe something you have planned for this weekend. Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also post on the Ideas Network Facebook page, and there it'll link over to WPR.org/Food Friday. You can get a few of the recipes for what to do with vinegar and how to make some of your own. We'll pick up the conversation coming up on Central Time. Right now, we're picking up the conversation with Chef John Sawyer. He's the owner of several Ohio restaurants, and he's the author of the new cookbook, House of Vinegar, The Power of Sour. And you can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you use lots of vinegar in your cooking? What kinds? Are you a vinegar nerd? Have you ever made your own? Our guest's new book has a lot of advice and recipes on how to do exactly that, make a bunch of different kinds of vinegar. Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page to your calls now. Rebecca is with us in Madison. Rebecca, hi there.
Hi.
What do you want to tell us about, Rebecca?
Well, I'm calling because I had recently made chicken adobo, and it seems that vinegar is like one of the main ingredients in chicken adobo, and you cook it in, I think there's like two-thirds a cup in the recipe, and I wasn't terribly satisfied. I liked it, it was fine, but I wonder, is there a particular kind of vinegar you should use for that kind of recipe?
What kind did you use, Rebecca?
Yeah, the old white.
Was it braised or marinated? If you could tell me too, because then I can help you decipher it.
You brown the chicken, little slices of chicken breast, and then you add in. Then you do like vinegar and onion, and then you cook it in the vinegar. No, garlic and onion. Then you cook it in the vinegar and soy sauce, and. I use just like regular white vinegar that's been in my cupboard.
Gotcha.
Yes. Like a distilled white vinegar?
Yeah.
So for me, I think distilled white vinegar is a great use in sort of very extreme versions of pickling. As a cooking medium, it isn't phenomenal. I think about vinegar the same way I think about wine. If I would drink it as a glass of wine, I would cook with it. If I taste the vinegar and say, this tastes okay, I could make a vinaigrette from this, I would use it in cooking, saucing, brining, et cetera. If it doesn't taste good, I would know that this is something that is too high of an acidity or too singular of a taste for me to actually enhance my dish with. So I'll use it just for a marinade or for a pickle. And I also think adobo is a very personal thing, too, you know, from mom to mom, the house to house, whether you're in Puerto Rico or Mexico or even other parts of the world, you could see a little bit of orange juice replace that 100% vinegar, and it's a little bit of a milder, sweeter sort of finish.
Right, and if she wanted to try a different vinegar, what would she reach for in an adobo?
I would say a white wine vinegar or a very light beer vinegar would be ideal. Champagne vinegar may have too much acidity, similar to the white distilled vinegar, but it all depends on brand and pH.
Fantastic. Rebecca, I hope that helps out with the next round of chicken adobo. We'll go now to George with us in Green Bay. George, hi.
Hi, how are you?
Good. What do you have for us, George?
Oh, I was happy to hear there's a vinegar cookbook. I love vinegars.
Me too, brother.
Yeah, I was, you know, it's so easy to use, you know, to do like a hot meat salad. I tend to use lamb for myself, but other people like beef, where you just saute off the cubes of tenderloin really quick, get her some shallots, deglaze the pan with a little bit of apple cider or sherry vinegar, add a little walnut oil, and then sprinkle some goat cheese on top of like arugula.
Ooh.
And then just take in. And you take the, obviously you take the beef out before you deglaze the pan. Just put on the salad and just deglaze it and pour it on top. It's great stuff. Just pepper, black pepper on it.
Fantastic, George. Thanks a lot. And John, can you talk about how vinegar brings out, it's not just the flavor of the vinegar. Talk about how it brings out some of those other flavors. In this case, it was beef or lamb and the goat cheese and the arugula. But it plays well with others very often.
Yeah, much like salt, and when we're talking about the equation of flavor, it enhances all properties of whatever it is involved with. So whether it's finishing a sauce, like George said, and deglazing the pan and making a hot vinaigrette, you will take the caramelized bit of either lamb or beef, depending on what you're doing, and you will enhance it with the acidity, which allows your taste buds to experience and open, you know, the entirety of your mouth, what is good inside of that beef or lamb.
George, thanks a lot for that call at 800-642-1234. Talking to Jonathan Sawyer, his new book is House of Vinegar, The Power of Sour. Back to your calls now. Jim is with us in St. Croix Falls. Jim, hello.
Hi.
Hi, what did you want to ask about?
Well, I wanted to ask a little bit more about the actual making of vinegar. Doesn't it start out with alcohol? And how do you... And the mother of vinegar, could you talk a little bit more about that and how you determine at the beginning of the process how strong your vinegar, what percentage it would be at the end of the process?
Great. Thanks for the call. Let's start with, you mentioned
great,
the mother of vinegar, John, and that's a
yeah.
That's a part of the equation. What is that?
So the mother of vinegar is also sometimes referred to as SCOBY, which stands for System of Coexisting Bacteria, Organisms, and Yeast. And whether you're talking about yogurt, cheese, kombucha, or vinegar, that is what Acetobacter transfers, whatever your base is, to eventually what your finished product is. Now, you can buy mother online, and that's fine, and that's something that you do maybe to kickstart it, but inevitably, if you're making vinegar, you will have a mother whether you see it or not. In some of the extreme and longer fermentations, the mother can end up looking like almost like a jellyfish, where these sort of different microorganisms sort of bind to each other and float in the middle of the product. So it looks really cool and it's very easy to sell, but at the end of the day, it's going to turn to vinegar no matter what you do. So you can spend the money and you can make it that, and that's good, and that'll kickstart it. But you also can just pour the liquid into a vessel that's porous and wait, and eventually you will have your own mother, and that is individual to you and your neighborhood.
And Jim was also wondering about, you know, starting at the outset and figuring out how strong you want your vinegar to be. What kind of things determine that?
Way less complicated question than mother and Scooby, for sure. For us, there's a weird thing about acidity and basicness that people don't often understand, but the reduction of acidity does not increase the pH of acidity. So if I have a gallon of vinegar and I reduce it to a tablespoon, it'll be the exact same sourness as it was at the end as it is in the beginning. So what we like to do with our vinegars, and we call it sort of jokingly but almost seriously, we take them to clinical strength, right? So we take them to the most acidic place that we can sort of taste with our taste buds. Typically, that's at about a 1.7 on a pH scale. 3.5 is federally approved as safe. right? So you're going below 3.5. And then as a cook or as a home cook, you have the opportunity to either dilute your vinegar or use it at that full strength. So we try to take our vinegars as sour as possible, but they are safe at 3.5.
And how do you control that acidity when you set it up?
It's time. So what we do is, you know, there's a timeline on everything, right? I said beer vinegar goes as quick as 1 month. Red wine vinegar, the quickest I've ever done it in the natural process, which is what we do, is 6 months. But we smell it on a regular basis, and acidity is very, very easy to identify. And then as you do it more often, understand how intense it is. And when it smells to us and the time is close enough to us that we think it is a vinegar, we just take a pH strip. Just, you can buy them anywhere. They're the cheapest thing you could ever imagine. You pop it in there, and you understand what acidity you're at. And if you want it to be stronger or you want it to be more acidic, you just wait longer. Or what you could do is, you know, say you're at a 3.0 and you don't need that much vinegar, you can just take out a little bit of vinegar and add more of the liquid that the vinegar was based on back in, and it'll speed up the process for the next time. So like great vinegar makers, probably most specifically Italians and Spaniards, what they would do in their home kitchen is, you know, they obviously have a little more restraint on drinking than Americans, most specifically myself, but at the end of supper, they would take whatever wine is left over, they would pour it into their vinegar vats, and then the next day they could use that exact same vat of vinegar because it is so old and it is so active, huh. It is so low in pH, that they can pull some out and they have vinegar that is nonstop, almost on tap.
Thanks a lot for that call. I want to take a quick peek, John, before we're done, at this other recipe you gave us at WPR.org/Food Friday, the apple tart tatine. I don't know if I'm saying that right. Just briefly sell us on that one.
Yeah, I mean, that is, you know, not American apple pie because it's probably closer to ches pie, but it is the quickest, most delicious way to celebrate the fall season. And puff pastry is something you can make a labor of love or you can purchase at the store. But the balance of apple acidity plus vinegar acidity plus caramelized sugar plus dough is bliss.
And that's with apple cider vinegar to complement those apples.
Absolutely, if possible. But I also love beer vinegar in there. You know, apple, it's such a robust dessert. You know, we're not talking about, like, something that can't take a little bit of a bruising or a hard pairing. You can use almost any vinegar in that recipe because of the caramelized sugar and because of the identity of the apples. It's basically fancy French apple pie.
John, thanks a lot for joining us today. It's been a lot of fun.
My pleasure, absolutely.
That's Jonathan Sawyer. He's a chef and founder of several restaurants living in Cleveland, Ohio. He's won a James Beard Award. He describes himself as vinegar obsessed. His new book is House of Vinegar, The Power of Sour. You can find the recipes we talked about today and one more, sauerkraut balls that use some of his vinegar. They use the vinegars he talks about, plus some explanations of how to make a couple of the kinds of vinegar in his book. You can find those online at WPR.org/Food Friday. Get there via the Ideas Network Facebook page. I see we've got at least one listener recipe up there that looks really good, too. You can share your favorite ways to use vinegar and maybe a picture of your vinegar-making apparatus if you do that at home. There's been a big move lately for people who work at desks, you know, work in offices, to get standing desks or those up and down ones. The big selling point is that sitting is bad for our cardiovascular health and standing more is going to be good for our hearts. Well, an article in the New York Times rounds up a lot of the research on the heart benefits of standing desks, and it finds out there may not be a lot of heart benefits for standing desks. Now, this one hits home for me. I am standing right now, actually. They have microphones rigged here so I can sit. We can sit or stand in here. And I have one of those up or down, just one of those things you put on top of your desk. And, you know, I felt pretty virtuous that I was, you know, sort of getting exercise while I stood there. Turns out, no, I'm not. No big heart benefits there. But on the upside, they say, well, it might be better for your posture and to help prevent back pain in the long run. So my initial reaction was something along the lines of, you know, shut your lying mouth. I love my standing desk and my standing studio workstation. But I guess there's still no replacement for actually moving around and exercising. Upside, when I'm working at my standing desk, I am more prone to just walk around a little bit, walk out in the hallway, visit my neighbors, good social thing. So all things considered, weigh it, I'll stick with it. Let us know if you have embraced the standing desk or rejected it. Email us, ideas@WPR.org, or tweet us @CentralTimeWPR. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network.